I next met with Dr. Jaffer Ajani, who reviewed with me recent developments in clinical and translational research in esophagogastric cancer, beginning with the landmark study reported last year of trastuzumab, as commented on previously by Dr. Grothy.
This is a nice example of how we can make future advances, where you take a subset of gastric cancer patients that express HER2-new, and then the trial was done in that subset, and it demonstrated that a relevant drug like Herceptin prolonged all the endpoints that was predominantly the overall survival and progression-free survival without contributing anything to the toxicity. So I think obviously the challenge is to identify another subset among gastric cancer patients. And for that, a lot of molecular biology research is necessary. But I think this clearly suggests that if you have a patient in the clinic with advanced gastric cancer, particularly if they have moderately differentiated or well-differentiated tumor, then you got to consider testing for HER2-new.
Could you talk a little bit about the issue in terms of HER2 testing? I've heard that it's maybe a little bit more challenging than in breast cancer because of tumor heterogeneity.
Exactly. So I think this is also a new issue for GI cancer doctors, because we really did not delve into HER2 testing before. And all the pathologist knowledge has been based on breast cancer. And so it seems like what is relevant in breast cancer does not necessarily apply in gastric cancer. To give you an example, what I've been told that FISH-positive breast cancer will respond beneficially to Herceptin. So Herceptin is beneficial to HER2 FISH-positive cancers, but that's not necessarily the case for gastric cancer. So if we look at this TOGA trial that screened close to 4,000 patients and treated about 600 patients, there, the subgroup analysis suggests that if you took just FISH-positive and IHC-negative patients, there doesn't seem to be much benefit. So the patients that benefited the most were those with IHC3+ positive, irrespective of the FISH results, which is quite different. And I sat through one meeting where there were a number of breast pathologists who were teaching us about the HER2 staining and all the issues surrounding that. And they had done a few gastric cancer cases also. And they thought that even the geography of breast cancer, HER2 distribution is quite different than gastric cancer. So it seems like, you know, obviously what is driving breast cancer in HER2 pathway may be quite different compared to gastric cancer. So we have to learn a lot, but what I'm trying to do for my patient is asking for IHC, definitely, and collecting data on FISH.
So it's been about a year now since that data set was presented. Have you treated patients with trastuzumab?
Yeah, actually, I wanted to give you an example of a patient that we treated 4 years ago. So we've been treating patients long before these data had come out, because we were aware that there was a subset of patients with HER2-positive tumors, so we've been trying to treat. So I have dozens of patients who have been treated before the TOGA trial has come out. And to give you one example of a patient who, like an executive type in mid-40s, athletic at the same time, went to his primary physician just for a routine physical examination, and on routine chest x-ray had multiple huge pulmonary mets. And then they started studying him more, and they found there was a large proximal gastric cancer. So he flew down from West Coast to see us. And one of the first things we did was another endoscopy, because we didn't have unstained slides, and did the HER2 testing on him, and actually started him on 5 drugs all at once. Because this gentleman, you know, he was in total shock. So he wanted everything done to him just to get rid of this cancer, which we told him that that would be almost impossible because he's got widely metastatic disease. But I started him on Avastin, Herceptin, docetaxel, oxaliplatin, and 5-FU, all five at once. And he had a dramatic response. Actually, he is now disease-free 4 years later.
Wow.
He's still on Herceptin. So he's been on Herceptin for 4 years and taking Doxil in addition to, because he progressed and then we reinstituted CPT-11. But I kept the Herceptin going. I dropped Avastin after the Avagast trial that was just presented this ASCO meeting. So I think this is, you know, one dramatic example of the HER2-positive patient. When you put them on Herceptin, they seem to just coast along for a very, very long time.
That's really amazing. Where exactly was the site of the primary, and what do we know about the correlation between the location of the primary and the type of gastric cancer and the likelihood of being HER2-positive?
Okay, so that's a very good question. So this is why I was mentioning that if a patient has well-differentiated or moderately differentiated tumor, then we should consider testing for HER2 immediately. So intestinal type of tumor, which is usually well-differentiated, moderately differentiated, often located in the lower half of the stomach, that's the one more likely to be HER2-positive. The rate can be up to 20%. But as we go proximally towards the GE junction, the tumor tends to become poorly differentiated and tends not to be HER2-positive. So I think for all lower half of the stomach, patients should probably be checked. Also, women are more likely to be HER2-positive than men, and that's because of the localization of the primary tumor.
Are there any major U.S. studies, or are you doing any studies at MD Anderson looking at trastuzumab or anti-HER therapy right now in gastric cancer?
Actually, we are not doing any study at the moment. There was an offer to do lapatinib study, but it was in the second line, and we really don't have such a large population. So right now we are actually collecting data from the retrospective tumor bank that we have. And I think the same thing is going on at Memorial Sloan Kettering, but there are no active studies.
What about the choice of chemotherapy to combine with trastuzumab? What are the options that you usually consider? And what about in the patient who has a HER2-negative tumor?
So in a HER2-positive tumor, the TOGA trial was done with a platinum compound like cisplatinum and fluoropyrimidine, and there was a choice of capecitabine versus 5-FU. But most people chose capecitabine. So 80% of TOGA population actually got capecitabine, interestingly. But I don't really think that, because it was such a clean trial, it was chemotherapy plus placebo versus chemotherapy plus Herceptin. So I think what TOGA trial demonstrated, that addition of Herceptin adds to survival and time to progression. So I think you can take Herceptin and add to any combination. So I use modified DCF regimen, which has docetaxel, oxali, and capecitabine or FU. And that's the combination that seems to have high response rate. Then you add Herceptin and you get another 10%.
What about in the HER2-negative situation?
HER2-negative is a real challenge, I think. And there we are using off-protocol modified DCF or oxaliplatin plus capecitabine. And you don't really have many choices there, because I use irinotecan, but in second line. And so you have only four classes of drugs we can use in HER2-negative patients. And that would be fluoropyrimidine, platinum compounds, taxanes, irinotecan. So if you use three of them up front, then you're just left with one more. So it's a tough situation we really haven't made much progress there.
Any new research endeavors in gastric cancer that you think are promising or exciting? Any agents or strategies?
So that's a very good question, because, you know, the Avagast trial that has almost 800 patients that was presented at this ASCO a couple of months ago, and it's a negative trial, but if we look at the data by region, it actually is a very interesting effect by region. So what actually was noted that in Asia, the difference between control arm and the experimental arm was the narrowest. And it was the largest in South America, for example. And it was intermediate in Europe. So had the trial been done in Europe and South America, it would have been a positive trial. So I'm working with another compound, which is a VEGFR2 tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And we have already completed a multi-institutional phase 2 trial, and the response rate and tolerance is absolutely excellent. So we're going to pursue that in phase 3. So I think that would be one. And we're going to try to reduce the Asian population in that trial. So I think you just learn the lessons from other trials and try to improve upon that.
Going back to the Avagaz study, could you go through the eligibility and design of that study?
Yes. So the design of the study was a combination of capecitabine and cisplatinum plus bevacizumab versus placebo. And this is a frontline study, and usual exclusion for bevacizumab, you know, with hypertension or bleeding tendency or wound infection and so on. And so they recruited a very large number of patients, I think 780 patients, at a very rapid pace. So within 12 to 15 months, they accrued all the patients. They couldn't do interim analysis. So I think that there is a disadvantage in going like an express train, because you lose track of what may be, you know, happening in different sites. And you spread out the study to numerous investigators. But nevertheless, actually the experimental arm, the median survival was longer, was 12 months. And control arm had 10 months. But still the p-value was 0.1. So they, of course, needed less events in the experimental arm, and they didn't have it.
It's interesting about what you were saying in terms of the Asian population. I think it was HCC where kind of the same thing was seen. I think it was with sorafenib. Any explanations here? You know, when these things happen, people talk about pharmacogenomics, or what do you think was going on?
It's interesting you bring up the HCC scenario, because the second sorafenib trial that was done in Asia, the difference between the two arms was very narrow. Was not as big as in the SHARP trial. The SHARP trial was conducted in Europe predominantly, and there was a big difference. So in HCC, at least, it is being postulated that the difference may be because of the differences in the etiology of hepatocellular carcinoma. So there is more alcoholic cirrhosis and fewer viral hepatitis in Europe, and there is predominantly virally induced hepatocellular carcinoma. And they were more advanced patients, probably sicker livers in Asia. So the lifespan of the patient is much shorter also. But in terms of gastric cancer, we know that there are considerable differences in Asian and Western population in terms of the SNPs for metabolizing different drugs. And other differences are really, they need to be found. I think this the research that needs to be done. And we are really not addressing that completely at the moment. I think, you know, the future is going to be with biomarker-driven therapeutics, and imaging will be integrated with that. And I think, you know, we want to make an appeal to the clinicians out there who are working in a non-university setting that some sort of network effort needs to be made to start collecting tissue and blood in community setting. I think our future is by collecting this resource to do, you know, the biomarker discovery. And then eventually everyone, for example, for HER2-new, you need unstained tissue. So everybody will have to get used to collecting a little bit of blood for extra testing and tissue for, you know, biomarker testing.
Just to get back to the issue of bevacizumab and gastric cancer, essentially, is that issue sort of a closed door? Are they going to go back and look at the tumor specimens to see if there is a subset that they can tease out?
Yeah, they are. Actually, they have a lot of blood and tissue, and they mentioned to me that they are going to do that. They're also considering a second trial, which will be, again, based on the subgroup analysis to focus on certain populations where Avastin may actually be very beneficial.
Do you have any speculations about what those populations might be? You mentioned SNPs before, and the only thing I've seen in all the different tumors was in breast cancer. There was a pretty interesting report out of Indiana suggesting the SNPs might be related to benefit from bevacizumab. Anything that you've seen that looks interesting, particularly in gastric cancer?
We don't, because I have some knowledge of the telatinib-related biomarker evaluations. And there is actually circulating VEGFR2 receptor. That seems to be initial levels as well as the change in the level. That seems to predict, albeit the data are in smaller number of patients, but I think this is what needs to happen in the future, that we could select certain patients. So a SNP, I don't know, but I think there are blood biomarkers that could become useful.
Can you talk a little bit about your initial approach to the patient with gastric cancer, and specifically in what situations you consider neoadjuvant therapy?
For patients with localized disease, if I see them first, I would refer them to the gastroenterologist, you know, for the initial staging and initial evaluation. So we involve a number of disciplines. So it would be gastroenterology, it would be radiation oncology, surgery, and then the medical oncology. We all get the initial evaluation. Once the staging is completed, then we sort of discuss among ourselves and then present the options to the patient. And usually there are at least two options for every patient. One approach will be the pre-op therapy, followed by surgery, followed by question mark. And the second approach will be surgery first, followed by question mark, depending on what we find. But our preference at my institution is really to treat before surgery is performed, because I think that really is a much better approach in terms of tolerance, and I think it's probably more beneficial.
Any interest, you know, your pulmonary colleagues, particularly Roy Herbst, reported on this at the ASCO meeting in non-small cell, the BATTLE study, where they actually were able to execute this study where they did pre and post biopsies and then chose the novel agent based on that. Any kind of thinking about trying to do that in gastric cancer? I mean, theoretically, I guess you could access tissue through endoscopy.
Yeah. So we are collecting tissue endoscopically at baseline, but I think we are behind the common tumors, but that would be the idea. And something like that is going to happen in colon cancer. With gastric cancer, I think this sort of strategy could happen in Asia, where there have got a lot of patients and a lot of governmental interest. We don't really have that at the moment, but I think, you know, something like that will have to be done.
Can you talk a little bit about the trajectory in terms of gastric cancer incidence internationally and also in the United States over the last 50 years and also over the last, you know, say, decade?
Yeah, so the gastric cancer incidence, when we talk about gastric cancer and the incidence, we're predominantly referring to the cancer in the lower half of the stomach. That has gone down everywhere, even in endemic countries like Japan and Korea or many South American countries, and definitely gone down here. What is happening in the Western countries, Western Europe, North America, is there has been dramatic rise in the proximal gastric cancer, GE junction cancer, lower esophageal adenocarcinoma. And I think this increase in the incidence is higher than any other cancer, at least in North America. So this is very alarming and probably related more to acid reflux rather than H. pylori infection, which plays a major role in gastric cancer in the lower half of the stomach. And not much is being done for that. Unfortunately, there is no government money set aside to do research for gastroesophageal cancer. And I think that needs to be done. And we don't fully understand this, because initially we thought that Caucasian men in their 50s who are a little bit obese with prolonged history of gastroesophageal reflux disease were getting it. But now I'm seeing women, Caucasian women, non-Caucasian population, even African Americans are coming down with proximal gastric cancer, gastroesophageal cancer. So it's becoming a disease of lifestyle rather than certain ethnic preponderance. And as you well know, that the U.S. population you know, the BMI continues to increase. And I think that may be the reason for this dramatic increase in this type of malignancy.
And if it is related to the BMI, what would the specific mechanism, do you still think that is tied into the reflux?
Right. So there are two important issues there, and it's a very good question, because one is, it is very well known that if you have truncal obesity, the chance of having nocturnal gastroesophageal reflux is extremely high. So we know that. Then there is a very large meta-analysis that has looked at BMI and GERD. So the risk of gastroesophageal reflux disease is high. They also looked at the risk of adenocarcinoma in the gastroesophageal region, and that's also high. And it's higher for the highest level of BMI, like above 30, which is considered morbid obesity. This is the mechanical issue of GERD leading to cancer. But the second issue is that the fat cells in the truncal region, they produce inflammatory cytokines. So it seems like fat cells in different parts of the body really have a different pathways that are activated, and they're elaborating different chemicals. For example, the so-called brown fat, which is around the neck and mediastinum, that is actually beneficial to us because it consumes huge amount of glucose and other calories. And on the other hand, the fat cells in the trunk is producing all these inflammatory cytokines that are circulating at high level. So that is a second contribution to generation of gastroesophageal cancer. Is inflammation independent of the reflux and compounding with reflux?
That's really fascinating. I mean, the simplistic idea I've had in terms of reflux is just in chronic irritation. Is that the way you see it?
Right. So, I mean, that's also a very interesting subject, because, you know, what happens with reflux is you get heartburn, and I've had occasional ones. Thankfully, I don't get it on a regular basis. But you do get very severe pain. And so the first reaction, if you go to your physician, or you can do it yourself, is go over the counter and take something to suppress the acid. So by doing that, you suppress 80% of the acid. And actually, you get symptomatic relief. That's why we have so many TV ads out there. So you're really happy because you can eat the same thing and you're not getting symptoms anymore. But in reality, we have not really solved the problem of reflux. The mechanical problem is still there. So instead of acid, you get the bile reflux. And bile is just as detrimental to the GE junction as acid is. And in laboratory studies, there are a number of models where bile can induce this type of cancer just as easily as acid can. So this is what is happening. I think most of the patient population that had been symptomatic with GERD, they are suppressing their acid and they're still getting cancers.
I was just flashing on a conversation I had with another one of your colleagues, John Haymock, about, you know, this concept of cancer as a wound that doesn't heal. I've always been fascinated by that. Any thoughts about that and how that might tie into this pathophysiologic complex you're describing?
So it's a very interesting topic because it really boils down to what is causing the tumor. What cell actually turns into cancer? And the terms that are being thrown around is cancer stem cell or tumor-initiating cells. And I think tumor-initiating cell, the terminology is much more benign. But essentially, the way we are thinking about in an inflammatory milieu of a tissue, the normal adult stem cells are called upon to repair the area. So once you have inflammation, the message goes to the adult stem cells that are sitting quietly in their niche, and they get animated and they repopulate the tissue. But if there is chronic injury, they are being called upon over and over and over. So you have to think about that situation where you have to repair a tissue again and again, as opposed to, suppose I was a car mechanic and I was just repairing the brakes over and over. I will get better with time. But the adult tissue stem cells, actually, they don't get better. And the reason is, because it's not the same cell that comes back to repair. It's a self-renewed cell. So it's a novice, normal stem cell that is coming back to repair. And if they have to do it over and over and over, these novice cells then undergo some sort of accident, which is the first mutation. So the concept is that adult normal stem cell, during the process of repetitive repair, confront an accident where a mutation occurs. Once the cell is mutated, then the second mutation is easier to come by. And then there is a point where the cell will either die or become immortal. I mean, there is a threshold where the stress in the tissue is so high that many cells cannot survive. So the theory goes that there are many clones that are trying to populate the area, and then one of the clones will survive all the stress because they have acquired so many mutations and acquired the ability to survive the stress. And that's the beginning of cancer.
So if you think about that model, what would be the implications for therapy or treatment?
So therapy is really complicated because, as you know, that over the years we've been busy reducing the proliferating cells. All our drugs were attacking the proliferation. And that's why I think we cannot cure many adult solid tumors. Because the moment you reduce the proliferating compartment of a tumor, then the signal goes to the cancer stem cells, which are sitting quiescent, and they are not being affected by chemotherapy. I'm just generalizing for time being. We can come back to the specifics. But if you think about it, that if I give 5-FU and docetaxel and they're both interfering with proliferation, then you get a partial response or near complete response. And then after a while, the tumor becomes resistant because it starts to grow again. And the repopulation is actually more resistant population, and you have to change chemotherapy. And then suppose you're lucky, with a second line you get another response, but then later on the tumor repopulates. So essentially what is happening is that you're leaving the stem cell compartment alone. You're always attacking the proliferating compartment, and every time you treat the proliferating compartment, you're producing more resistant next generation. And eventually the tumor becomes so resistant that it doesn't respond to anything you have. And that's what you see in the clinic. So how do we deal with this situation? It's going to be very complex because now you have several issues to deal with. One is the cancer stem cell itself. So we don't really know how to attack them. And I think obviously more research will help to identify biomarkers or pathways that are employed by cancer stem cells. Second thing is the niche, the stroma is protecting and co-opting with the cancer stem cells or tumor-initiating cells. So we have to learn to disrupt the niche. And I think the more modern concept is probably coming from hematologic malignancies, where we know that there is tremendous plasticity in the model. So the theory goes that the tumor-initiating cells are not necessarily the cancer stem cells, but the stemness can be acquired by early progenitor cells, so they can revert back. And I think this is substantiated by the iPS cells, which is to induce pluripotent cells. You know, some of the research that was recently done where they took skin cells and reverted them back to stem cells, embryonic stem cells, just by modifying 4 genes. So we know that there is this plasticity that exists, and cancer cells can also employ that plasticity. So theoretically, any cancer cell can acquire this stemness and then repopulate the tumor. So if you believe that, then we have to kill the proliferating compartment, we have to kill the stem cell, and we have to kill the stroma, the niche. And there may be other cells that need to be killed.
I remember a conversation I had with Ed Lin, who was previously at your place, about this concept of stemness. And until you just went through that stuff just now, I didn't really associate the stem cells with repair.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is it's part of the ongoing repair process.
It is. I mean, we have to think of cancer as an organ. It really inherited all the conserved properties of survival. And one of the requirements for survival is proliferation and reconstitution. So the tumor mass is acting like an organ, like a liver. So if you scoop out a little bit of liver, it will regenerate. If you scoop out the cancer with chemotherapy, you kind of reduce the bulk of the tumor, it will repopulate again. So it's behaving like an organ. But the complexity of cancer versus the normal organ is that cancer is an evolutionary model. So what we have is dysregulated cells that are trying to act like the workers in the organ. But as they continue to proliferate, the next generation of cells are more mutated than the previous generation because they're already dysfunctional cells. And, you know, there is another complexity that now we know that if you accept that there is cancer stem cell in the primary tumor, now it's being recognized that that cancer stem cell is only good to repopulate the primary. It cannot migrate out. So in order to migrate, it has to have certain additional mutations. So that is another species of cancer stem cell that exists already. So in other words, if you imagine a patient who's got lung metastases, liver metastases, and primary tumor in place, you can think of that patient having at least three species of cancer stem cells. And there may be multiple. There may be multiple even within a single organ. So that will make the treatment very complex.
Now, these concepts that you're talking about, do they in any, as you were talking about it, another person I was thinking about was Larry Norton at Memorial, who's talked, he and his colleagues have talked about, quote, the self-seeding concept, that somehow there's a communication between the primary and mets. What do you think about that? And does that tie into what you're talking about?
Oh, I think it's a beautiful concept because, you know, then you have to think of cancer as an organism, not as an organ. So it is communicating just like the bacteria do. Bacteria communicate as a mass with, you know, chemical signals, just like the ants do. So the cancer does. There is actually one good example of how the cancer metastasizes. This is fascinating because what they have shown, and I don't remember the group, that say, for example, from stomach primary, the cell is destined to go to the liver. So we know that it has to be a cell with a stemness property. So it has to be like a cancer stem cell or tumor-initiating cell. Now, tumor-initiating cell cannot just get into the bloodstream and go and lodge itself in the liver anywhere. So because of just the nature of things, because it has to be in a niche. A niche is a group of cells, you know, in an inflammatory stroma. So basically what has been demonstrated that the primary tumor releases cytokines that actually go to the liver and cause inflammation. And then the cell with metastatic potential then will travel over there and get lodged in the inflamed area. So this is a beautiful experiment. If you think about it in a very simple term, it would be like you're going to Chicago, but you're not going to go to Chicago and then try to find a hotel room. You're going to first make a reservation, and then you're in your hotel room. So there is this issue of communicating widely, but more specifically, you know, Dr. Fisher from NSABP, he had done some beautiful experiments before. When he removed the primary, the metastasis regressed. And so there has to be some sort of communication going on between the primary tumor and metastasis, and maybe even more complex.
It is interesting. You know, I guess we were all kind of disappointed that the neoadjuvant studies in breast cancer that were based on Dr. Fisher's work didn't really show any difference in terms of survival or disease-free survival. But on the other hand, they were using chemotherapy.
That's right. So I think eventually the medicine, at least cancer medicine, I think it's going to get into subsets. It's really identifying subsets and treating everybody. And I think the expensive drugs will not be expensive because you will not be giving it to 100 patients. You'll give it to only 10 patients who are likely to benefit. So the cost is going to go down.